Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention, shall be heard.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Clerk will call a case, please.
Case number 21-16, Colorado, petitioner Henry Kim, arguing for respondent and father, are denying merits.
And good morning. May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Henry Ting, presenting oral arguments on behalf of petitioner Jason Kalaoa. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And in this case, there was insufficient evidence presented at trial to show that Jason Kalaoa was guilty of the failure to disperse pursuant to Hawaii Revised Statute 711-1102. Now, the facts and the evidence presented are kind of like the incident itself on the early morning of May 19th, 2007. It's not the record is not entirely clear, but I think what's important is that the evidence that was presented is divided in terms of space, in terms of time. There were incidents that happened on the second floor of Aloha Tower Marketplace and incidents that happened on the first floor of Aloha Tower Marketplace. The trial prosecutor himself agreed that there are conducts on both places, the first and second floor. The prosecutor himself argued that in his closing and agreed to an arceo instruction, a unanimity instruction, that there were conducts on both floors. Now, I understand that the state on appeal now has added an additional argument that it may be a continuous course of conduct. It is our position that the state should be judicially stopped from making that argument, since what was presented at trial is that there were two events, one on the second floor of Aloha Tower Marketplace and one on the first floor of Aloha Tower Marketplace. Now, for both sets of facts, in both locations, there was insufficient evidence presented to convict Jason Kalaoa. Now, so briefly, primarily on the second floor, where the affray, as testified, began, Jason Kalaoa did in fact disperse. He did in fact leave the second floor when ordered to by the police officers. On the first floor, there is insufficient evidence to show, in particular, that there were six or more people in the course of disorderly conduct in the immediate vicinity of Jason Kalaoa. And throughout, both on the first floor as well as on the second floor, there's insufficient evidence to show that there was disorderly conduct in general. Now, beginning just chronologically on the second floor, when police officers arrived, the initial responding officers was Officer Alapa as well as Officer Ka'io. When they arrived at Aloha Tower Marketplace that early morning of May 19, 2007, at around 12:35, they make no observations of anything occurring on the first floor when they first arrived. There's not even any evidence that they observed any people on the first floor of Aloha Tower Marketplace. They testified that when they went to the second floor, that's when they saw, according to Officer Lapa, 50 to 75 people engaging in a large affray. According to Officer Ka'io, maybe 30 to 40 people engaging in a large affray. What's important is that there is no testimony from the officers as to whether the public was annoyed, inconvenienced, or alarmed by this large affray. Now, when they observed this, the officers testified that they ordered, that they yelled for everyone to disperse, to leave the area. And Officer Alapa made observations that he saw the petitioner within the affray. Now, the next time Officer Alapa sees petitioner would be some 30 minutes later on the first floor. So, in fact, what the evidence shows is that the petitioner in this case, Mr. Kalaoa, did in fact respond to Officer Alapa's orders, Officer Ka'io's orders, to leave. He left from the second floor to the first floor. Now, the record is not very good in terms of the layout of Aloha Tower Marketplace, but certainly petitioner went from the second floor to the first floor. And according to Sergeant Lee himself, he saw the petitioner exit Aloha Tower Marketplace. According to the prosecutor in his argument on page 37 of it would be closing arguments, which is the testimony of April 17th, the transcript of April 17th of page 37, the prosecutor at trial himself argued that they basically exited Aloha Tower Marketplace. So the evidence shows that the petitioner did in fact obey, did in fact, from the second floor, once ordered to leave, did in fact leave. And so for that reason, there is insufficient evidence that the petitioner was guilty of failure to disperse, certainly from the second floor. In addition, there's insufficient evidence to show that there was in fact disorderly conduct on the second floor. Disorderly conduct per 711-1101. Now, as opposed to how the trial court erroneously allowed the jury to determine disorderly conduct from their common experiences and their common understandings.
Mr. Ting, the prosecution in final argument argues that the officer Alapa 10 times asked the defendant to leave the second floor. Is that correct?
Well, Officer Alapa's specific testimony is that he ordered the group, ordered everyone in the fray, and his comments were not directed to any one person. That Officer Alapa ordered and specifically made those, basically yelled at the crowd to disperse. There's no evidence in terms of the timing of that, whether he did that 10 times, 10 times one after the other, or spaced apart. What is clear from the evidence, however, is that Officer Alapa makes his observation of the defendant. And in fact, it's unclear in terms of the chronology of it, whether he sees the defendant, makes his orders, or vice versa, whether he makes his orders, then sees the defendant. What's clear, however, is that Officer Alapa does observe the defendant, at some point gives the orders, and next time he sees the defendant is downstairs. Now, Officer Alapa testifies that they reached at the Aloha Tower Marketplace at approximately 12:35 in the morning. He makes one observation of the defendant on the second floor. The next time he sees the defendant is on the first floor. And we know that's approximately about a half an hour later because...
Mr. Ting, there's testimony from Officer Alapa, and if you could help us interpret this in light of your argument, that he addressed this general group of people and that the defendant was part of that general group, telling them to leave. And then the next question was, and did he leave at that time? Answer, no. Now, under the very deferential standard of review that we apply here, could that not support the inference that, in fact, the defendant failed to comply with the order, or what would your response be on that point?
Well, I think one of the considerations of that, it goes to the state of mind of knowingly, that the defendant knowingly, and there's no evidence that the defendant knowingly failed to reply. There's no evidence or no testimony that defendant acknowledged that. That defendant heard, and as which I think what can be logically inferred from the larger fray and numerous testimony that there was yelling and screaming during the whole time is that Officer Alapa and Officer Caillo's orders were one or two of many voices that was being heard that evening on the second floor, certainly.
Now, if the inference could be supported that the defendant had in fact heard, would that testimony be enough to support the conviction that he failed to disperse, or is the element of timing critical in your view here in terms of how long it took him to disperse?
Well, I think that's correct. That's correct as well, Justice Rechtenwald. As we make in our briefing, the statute itself doesn't have a requirement of timing. There's no requirement that one must immediately do so. I believe one would have to leave within a reasonable period of time after being ordered to do so. And the petitioner did so in this case.
Is there any evidence of when he left, when the defendant left the second floor?
I don't think there's any evidence in terms of the timing. Well, I take that back. I don't think there's evidence in terms of the specific time when he left the second floor. Defense witnesses testified that they broke down their equipment and they were carrying their equipment downstairs after the fray broke out. Take that for what you will. The jury, in large part, did not go with the defense, the testimony of the defense. I think perhaps it could be inferred that Sergeant Lee, who arrived, and Sergeant Lee testifies, he arrived at approximately 1 o'clock in the morning. And when he arrives, he sees defendant coming out of the Lahatara marketplace. So given Sergeant Lee's estimate, I think that may be inferred.
What may be inferred?
Well, in terms of approximately when the defendant came out of the Lahatara marketplace. And again, it wouldn't necessarily be when he left the immediate vicinity of Bikini's Cantina on the second floor, because all that Sergeant Lee testifies to is that is approximately the time he saw the defendant coming out of the Lahatara marketplace. And from the testimony, Lahatara marketplace is a mall with various shops and bars, an open air mall, and so there are. It's not like everybody came out of one store, one bar. It's a large complex, and so although we have a time frame in terms of when the petitioner came out of the Lahatara marketplace, I think it's unclear when he left Bikini's Cantina or the immediate vicinity of the affray that was occurring on the second floor.
So what was the outside limits of time?
I'm not sure of your question, Mr. Chief Justice. You're asking? Okay.
The police officer arrived about, 12:35?
Well, their testimony is they arrived at on the scene at around 12:35.
Okay. And at 1 o'clock is when the petitioner was seen coming out of the marketplace?
Out of the Lahatara Town Marketplace Mall, so according to Sergeant Lee.
25 minutes outside.
Well, I think it's going to be less than that, because for one, that officer testified that's when they 12:35 is when they arrive. They investigate downstairs before going, so there's a certain amount of time elapsed before they go upstairs. Again, it's unclear the evidence. The record's unclear in terms of when the officers give the order in terms of to disperse, and in terms of. 1 o'clock again. That is also an estimate from Sergeant Lee, and so I think on the outside, if that is what you're asking, on the outside, if we push it, it would be 25 minutes. But I think as a practical matter, in terms of the testimony, in terms of what had happened, in terms of the officers having to go to the second floor, and in terms of when people arrive, the logical inference is significantly less than that.
So are you admitting that he stayed on the second floor for 25 minutes?
No, we're not conceding he was on the second floor. I think, and again, as I stated, that is at the extreme, because the officers who arrived testified they arrived at 12:35. Again, they testified they looked around downstairs, seeing nothing, they proceeded to the second floor.
Did they establish how long after they arrived that they gave the warning? Do we know what time?
They do not give specific times in terms of when they go to the second floor. No. So they say they make observations on the first floor, and seeing nothing, they proceeded to where they heard the noise coming from the second floor. And you do have Officer Caillo testifying that. Officer Caillo testifying that it took approximately 5 minutes before people started going down. I know Officer Lapa testifies it was approximately 20 minutes. Well, I should clarify, not when people started to leave, but Officer Lapa testifies that within 20 minutes, most of the people had started streaming down. The people had started streaming down that even before that, there's testimony, I believe, from Officer Caillo that people started leaving even before backup police officers had arrived. And so, and clearly, officer, and clearly that was clarified by the state itself, although the times given by the officers were all approximate. And so no officer testified specifically that he arrived at a specific time. And so with regard to, on the second floor, again, the petitioner did in fact leave the second floor. He did in fact respond and obey the officer's orders to leave the second floor, as the second time Officer Lapa observes. And the second time Officer Lapa observes him, he's on the first floor.
Is there any evidence that Officer Lapa had the defendant in view all the time that he was on the second floor? That Officer Lapa was on the second floor?
No, in fact, Officer Lapa does not testify that he had a constant view of the defendant throughout the period of time. His testimony is that he made the observation of the defendant, and it was left at that. He testified that he proceeded to go on and break up fights and concentrate his attention on other matters. In fact, the trial prosecutor took pains to point out the chaos that was going on and that the officers weren't paying attention to any one person for a long period of time except to break up the fights. And the state itself went to pains to show that that no one officer was observing any one particular person throughout the whole time.
And you on appeal raised the alternative means theory. And at trial, though, the theory was, what is it, acts, multiple acts. So is this a multiple acts case?
It's both. It's both. There were multiple acts on both the first floor and the second floor, as I pointed out earlier, and as well that within each location, within the first floor and as well as within the second floor, there are alternative means from the statute. And so it is so like as the hypothetical that was given in State versus Jones. In that case, the hypothetical was with regard to two separate trespasses. And within each trespass, there's two possible ways to violate, which is to enter unlawfully or to remain unlawfully. Likewise, in this case, there were two separate locations of conduct.
If there are multiple acts, then must each act be supported by substantial evidence?
Yes, and in fact, the RCO the anonymity instruction was in fact given in this case, and primarily because there was, and as argued by the state, there were acts on the second floor as well as acts on the first floor.
Instruction is just that the jury has to unanimously agree on one of those acts.
The instructions in this case was generic, and that's correct. And so it was not tailored to the facts of the case. It was just a general RCO instruction in this particular case. Although there does seem to be some confusion of the parties, as well as the court, frankly, at trial with regard to whether RCO applied to the alternative means in this case. I believe at various points the court itself wasn't sure whether an RCO was required because the defendant could have been either one of the six or within the vicinity of one of the six people allegedly committing disorderly conduct. So now with regard to the first floor, is what occurred on the first floor, there's no evidence to support that the defendant petitioner in this case, Mr. Kalaola, was in the immediate vicinity of six people committing disorderly conduct. There's testimony from officers that there were individual affrays breaking out here and there, but there is no evidence that any of these affrays were within the vicinity of the defendant. There was no testimony that even if there was an affray near the defendant, that there were six or more people involved. Even if you go through the testimony, in light most favorable to the state, there's insufficient evidence to show that defendant was part of a group of six or within the immediate vicinity of a group of six. And so there's insufficient evidence on the first floor as well, as the conduct on the first floor in terms of failure to disperse. Now, on both the second and the first floors, as I discussed before, there's insufficient evidence to show that there was even disorderly conduct as defined in 711-1101. There's insufficient testimony, insufficient evidence to show that the public, people who were not involved in the affray, people who were not participating, as Officer Alapa testified, everybody was that he observed was involved in the affray. As Sergeant Lee testifies on the first floor, the people who were not were casual observers.
Mr. Ting, you argue that there wasn't substantial evidence of the offense. So how does that impact with the instruction concerning multiple, multiple acts?
Do you mean the alternative means or the two acts of the first and second floor, Justice Okoye?
The acts. No. With respect to the instruction says if you the jury must unanimously agree on at least one of the acts. I'm not sure if it exactly says that, but
well, the instructions could have been. It could have been less generic. The instruction, it was a generic Arceo instruction. It seems to have been clarified, at least on part of the state. The state very expressly argues that to the jury that, specifically pointing attention to the Arceo instruction, that acts occurred on the second floor and acts occurred on the first floor, and that the jury must be unanimous as to which one, as to which act occurred in terms of convicting. The state gave the example of you and told the jury you cannot six of you find something occurred on the second floor and six find on the first floor and convict. And so I think although the instructions
is it possible to determine which act the jury decided unanimously constituted the violation?
Well, there were no interrogatories, and so it was just a general verdict. And so, it's just the nature of the beast that.
My question was: is it possible to determine which act or acts the jury determined was proven beyond a reasonable doubt and base its verdict on? You said two acts were argued.
Correct. I think the short answer is no. It is not possible for us to determine which ones the which.
Well, in fact, the court instructed on the entire or gave the court the gave the jury an instruction on the entire statute. So, conceivably, there were four possibilities: participating in a disorderly conduct and being in the vicinity of disorderly conduct on the first floor and on the second floor.
That is entirely correct. There are four possibilities: the separate acts on the first floor and the second floor, as well as the alternative means within each geographic area, the first floor and the second floor. So that is entirely correct. There are four possibilities that the jury may have, that each juror may have.
Can you tell which one the jury hinged its verdict on?
I could not from reading from the record.
I'm saying generally, can anyone tell on which act the jury hinged its verdict on?
I think they could. From the record, I do not believe one could tell how the jury concluded, whether they convicted on the first floor or what happened on the first floor, what happened on the second floor. Now, I understand in state the law, well, assuming that the court determines that this is an alternative means statute, I do understand that State versus Jones does seem to imply that with an alternative means they don't have to be unanimous there. It's unclear to me, assuming that the court does determine that this is an alternative means statute, the jury would ultimately, there would only be two possibilities, and whether or not they found that the defendant was one of the six or within the immediate vicinity of one of the six, would not require, I mean, if the court does determine that, it would not be required to determine for them to be unanimous on that option. And that springs from State versus Jones as well as State versus, and which springs from State versus Kling. And I'm not sure that is a bit of a digression. I'm not sure that that's at all what flows. I mean, in State versus Jones, there just seems to be a conclusion that if there's alternative means, then it doesn't have to be unanimous. And there's no argument, there's no reasoning, except that that's how other people have done it.
It doesn't have to be unanimous if there are for both substantial evidence to support.
Well, that's correct. There must be substantial evidence for both alternative means.
Right.
State versus Jones seems to imply that at the trial level, when the jury is considering it, the jury does not have to be instructed that they must be unanimous on the alternative means. And the decision seems to imply that it could be six believe that he was within the vicinity, and six believe that. Six jurors believed he was in the vicinity, and six jurors believed that he was one of the six participating in disorderly conduct, and that would be okay. Jones seems to imply. I'm not clear in terms of whether the underpinnings of Jones, that conclusion from Jones is supported. Jones just seems to say that other people are doing. That's how other people have concluded, and that's how we will conclude. However, Jones looks at federal law for that. However, immediately after concluding that in Jones that there are alternative means statutes, in the next section, they say we're not going to follow federal law, and this state is going to require on review that there be sufficient evidence, and there they do diverge from federal law. And so,
Mr. King, if I could just sort of following up on this line of discussion and focusing in on the situation we're faced with here, you've argued there are two, in essence, separate incidents, one upstairs, one downstairs. If this court were to conclude that there was sufficient evidence as to one of those incidents but not as to the other incident, what would be the appropriate disposition of the case and why, in the defendant's view?
Well, if the court finds that there's insufficient evidence as to one of the alternatives, I believe certainly if the case is remanded, that alternative is foreclosed to the state in terms of retrial. I believe it would be sent back down on remand, and one of the alternatives would be foreclosed to the state.
Foreclosed in the sense of not being able to argue that it independently could be a source of liability, or foreclosed in terms of not even being able to refer to it in the evidence?
I think that's going to depend on whether it's going to be the first floor or the second floor. If this court finds that there's insufficient evidence on the second floor, there's no need to proceed to that evidence because that chronologically happens after what the officers wrote on the second floor.
Did the prosecution foreclose that theory by arguing there were two separate incidents? So if it would go back, there would be no basis for referring, for example, to the second floor, because the prosecution has already
argued the theory
that there were two separate incidents, one the second floor and the other on the first floor, either of which would be sufficient to convict.
I think that's right, that the facts for each, for what happened on the first floor and the second floor, are self-contained, and certainly the state does, the state does make that argument themselves. And
is
so,
there a double jeopardy issue here? If it was to be remanded and there was insufficient evidence as to one of the alternatives, if this is an alternative means case?
Well, I think, as I've stated, that if there is insufficient evidence for one of the alternatives, then that is foreclosed to the state in terms of its argument, and as Justice Acoba points out, also foreclosed in terms of its presentation of the evidence. And so I think that addresses the double jeopardy issue that may come up again on retrial. And so there's insufficient evidence on the first, what occurred on the first floor as well as the second floor. And we do ask the court, because of that, order that this case be dismissed with prejudice. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Justice Moon, Honorable Justices. May it please the court, I'm Ann Clarkin, representing the state. In this case, the prosecutor specifically argued that defendant was one of six or more persons participating in the course of disorderly conduct, likely to cause substantial harm or serious inconvenience. The jury instruction supplied the additional information that the jury could also convict defendant by finding that he was in the immediate vicinity of those engaging in disorderly conduct and knowingly failed to comply with the order to disperse. The ICA determined that when viewed in the light most favorable to the state, there was sufficient evidence to establish each of the alternative means, each four of them, two occurrences on the second floor and two on the first floor. The testimony of four police officers, the defendant was one of a mob of 50 to 75 people fighting, yelling, and otherwise engaging in tumultuous behavior on the second and the first floor at Bikini's Cantina, in front of the Aloha Tower Marketplace, in the parking area, and on the sidewalk in front. All established this. The testimony in this case adduced that there were approximately 200 people at Bikini's Cantina. The defendant himself said that, it was said that the place could sustain 300 to 350, and the defendant himself said that it was packed, standing room only. At 12:35, Officer Alapa was dispatched and arrived at Aloha Tower Marketplace. He and Officer Kaio went to the second floor where they heard yelling. And Officer Alapa thought he saw 50 to 75 people, and Officer Kaio thought he saw 30 to 40 people engaged in fighting. Those were only the ones engaged in fighting. Now, the previous testimony, there was testimony later by Kainoa Jardine that the 200 people were approximately 200 people that were in Rocky's Cantina. The fight broke out there, according to him, and the situation was so serious that they called security. Security was unable to assist, and they weren't able to stop the fight. So people were moved out of Bikini's Cantina to the outside. Now, Bikini's Cantina is an open air bar. If you're here, it's they're not walls, they're not windows. It's an open air bar. It's facing the ocean side of Aloha Tower Marketplace. You could be here and you'd be out if you stepped over here. What is agreed by the officers and by Kainoa Jardine is that the officers subsequently arrived and ordered people to leave the area. Officer Alapa testified that he was concerned because it was a violent and chaotic scene. He was concerned for people who could get hurt and fall from the second floor to the first. He testified that chairs were being thrown. The fighting encompassed the entire second floor, as testified by both officers Kaio and Alapa. Alapa observed the defendant specifically challenging people, which means challenging members of the public, to fight, calling out people, and he had an aggressive stance. Alapa addressed the defendant and the smaller group. He said the defendant was in a smaller group within a larger group fighting. He said he specifically addressed that group at least 10 times. Everyone is to leave, he said, go home or face getting arrested. Officer Alapa himself was involved in several altercations. Just giving you an idea of the violence and chaos that was going on there, Officer Alapa was involved in at least three physical altercations and was himself injured when he was punched in the eye. Defendant did not leave. They didn't arrest him, and Officer Alapa testifies that he didn't arrest defendant because there were only, initially there were only two officers, and he thought it was unwise. Two officers, 50 to 75 people fighting. He didn't think that was a good idea.
What is the evidence that he didn't leave, other than the testimony that I quoted earlier to Mr. Ting, in which Officer Alapa said he didn't leave? Is there any evidence as to how long he remained after the order was given?
Well, Officer Alapa said that he came on the scene, as you established, at approximately 12:35. And subsequently, he said that he told the defendant 10 times to leave. He isn't exactly sure in what time period that happened. But he did say that he told the defendant that many times, and the defendant did not leave.
Right. And is there any evidence as to any further follow-up to explain whether he didn't leave that moment, he didn't leave within 5 minutes, within 30 minutes, 20 minutes? Is there anything to establish how long the defendant lingered at the scene? And if not, what in the view of the state is the test that we should be applying to find out in terms of determining when a defendant should leave under those circumstances? Is the moment the order is given, 5 seconds later, 10 seconds later, what's reasonable, which is what Mr. Ting suggested?
Well,
what would be the test that you believe should be applied in assessing the sufficiency of the evidence here?
Approximately a half hour later, a defendant was observed streaming down the steps and out of the Aloha Tower Marketplace onto the front, and that was by Sergeant Lee. And that was, so it's approximately 20 minutes later than he left. Now, the state's...
How do you establish when the order was given?
I can't exactly. That's why I said approximately 20 when he arrived. It could have been longer than 20 minutes because he says he arrived at the front. Sergeant Lee says he arrived at the front of the Aloha Tower Marketplace, whereupon he saw people streaming down. And
I'm speaking of the time between the order and when he was seen on the first floor. You don't know when the order was given, whether it was 5 minutes after arrival.
That's correct.
12:35.
That's correct. There is nothing in the testimony that indicates that,
right.
Okay. other than the fact that he goes on to testify that he saw a defendant. Defendant didn't leave, if you're talking about Officer Alapa. And he says the reason he didn't arrest him for not leaving was because there weren't enough people. And then he goes on to say that the fight continued.
So what is the prosecution's position in response to Justice Reckonwald's question? What is the standard he uses? What is unreasonable?
I'm not sure that there is a specific standard, which is...
Well, the statute doesn't require a specific time after the order that the person should...
It doesn't require a specific time, Your Honor. I believe that when you're looking at orders given by the police, that one could possibly infer that the police want you to do it right away. Certainly, 20 minutes later, or more than 20 minutes later, is probably stretching the boundary there. But
that hasn't been established.
No, I suppose we're looking for you to do that here. One of the things I did want to address, however, was that, so this is what happened on the first floor, on the second floor, rather. On page 20 to 31, on pages 20 to 31 of the transcripts of the 16th, Alapa stated that it was 20 minutes before the crowd started to go downstairs. Now, Officer Cahill said that he called backup because there were too many, that there were only two of them, they needed the backup. And as many as 15 or 20 officers responded, but they didn't all respond at the same time, so they were coming sporadically from different areas. And after backup arrived, he said it took a while to gain control of the crowd on the second floor. So again, that time is ambiguous of what is a while. He said approximately 5 minutes, but he didn't say whether the 5 minutes was before the people started coming, the backup started coming, or 5 minutes after they all arrived that the people started to go down. So it is ambiguous. He said this crowd started running down the stairs, and the fights were breaking out as they went down the stairs on the first floor. On the second floor, defendant testifies that he didn't hear the police, but Kanoa Jardine, who said he was with defendant constantly, did hear the police. He said the police were yelling, and he could hear them from inside the bar. He said the exact statements was that when he questioned, when did the police arrive, were you aware of that? He said, yes. And what did the police do? They tried to get everybody to leave. How were they doing that? Yelling. Do you remember what they were saying? Kanoa Jardine answers, everybody go home. That's on page 155. It's the state position that it is a continuous course of conduct in a manner of speaking. Defendant was with a fighting group that went on with the fighting, an unruly mob that continued to fight down the steps and then came to the ground floor. He's left in the center. He left the center of the first occurrence, but he didn't start fighting. He continued the fight.
Ms. Clarkin, on that issue, what's your response to the defendant's argument that the prosecutor argued at trial in closing argument these were two separate incidents, they should be evaluated separately? Should that be the way we approach it, too, in assessing the evidence, or are we assessing evidence of one big incident and can take evidence from the upstairs, utilize it downstairs, or is it really two separate incidents?
Well, this is exactly what the prosecutor said as to that, Your Honor. The state's contention is that the disorderly conduct was a continuous course that happened from before officers Alapa and Cayo showed up on the scene and continued all the way until the time defendant was arrested. That's on page 123. He also said, what the testimony shows is there was fighting, there was arguing, there was swearing. There were people calling people out continuously through this point, and it took the officers a long time to control the situation. It was not an incident where disorderly conduct was going on the second floor, and then everything stops and it continues again later. This is one continuous action. That's page 124. So defendant, it's a state position that's the case. That's actually the case.
That was the defendant's closing. I'm sorry, the prosecutor's closing?
That was on page 123 and 24. Let me see.
In terms of the argument to the jury, I think what defense counsel was pointing to was the prosecutor's closing, in which the prosecutor appeared to characterize these as two separate incidents and told the jury that all 12 of you must agree that one of these incidents happened. So the prosecutor appeared to present the case to the jury as two separate incidents. And my question to you is, in view of that presentation of the case to the jury, should we on appeal be viewing this in the same way as two separate incidents, assessing the evidence with regard to the upstairs and the downstairs, in effect as if they were distinct offenses?
I think so. I think although they were offered as examples, that they do present two separate acts as under Jones. And the first act that could be that was alleged was on the second floor when he refused to leave following Officer Alapa's repeated orders to leave. And on the first floor, when he refused to leave following both Alapa's and Sergeant Lee's repeated orders to leave, I think that those were by way of example, but I think that what he was, trying to, in the judgment for acquittal, what he was trying to, well, I think what he was trying to present, that this was a continuous course. This was a mob. This was unruly individuals leaving the area. This was only from the one, there were 200 only in the Bikini's Cantina. There were many other bars, as you all know, in Aloha Tower Marketplace, and this was around closing time. So there were possibly, you know, other individuals there, although that was not part of the record.
Ms. Clark, in the closing argument by the prosecution was, what that means is that 12 of you must agree that the second floor incident happened or the first floor happened or both happened. Ladies and gentlemen, both did happen in this case. The defendant failed to comply with Officer Alapa's orders to disperse on the second floor, and he failed to comply with Sergeant Lee's orders to disperse on the first floor. So a continuous course of conduct was not the theory that the state proposed at trial or argued to the jury.
No, it was not, Your Honor. And the prosecutor's argument made that clear, that he was referring to the two acts.
So he treated those two as separate incidents.
Yes, examples of defendant's behavior that would satisfy the statute.
So there were two crimes charged in one count?
Well, you know, as motion as before, although the prosecutor stated explicitly that a defendant was one of the disorderly people, and that was stated well, the prosecutor argument was that defendant was one of the six people involved in disorderly conduct, one of the six out of 50 to 75 people, because the fight involved the entire concourse, and repeatedly the police officers are saying that the fights were breaking out everywhere. And as to the front, and I'm sorry, I forgot your question.
Do we hear, are we apparently, it appears based on where the discussion we've just had, that this is a case in which two distinct offenses were charged in one count, or at least that's how the prosecutor argued it to the jury.
There was an RCO instruction, so there were at least two separate incidences, which could have been proven either by alternate means that the defendant was a participant in the disorderly conduct, or he was in the vicinity, which is a subsection of the crowd.
And what would the implication be if the evidence were sufficient as to the upstairs or as to the downstairs, but not as to the other? What would be the appropriate disposition of the case in that circumstance, in the prosecution's view?
In the prosecution's view, that that under Jones, prosecution is not, retrial is not barred on the means of establishing guilt for which there was sufficient evidence presented at trial. So whichever means is thought to have sufficient evidence will not be barred from retrial.
But the other would be barred?
If there was a sufficient means,
that's the implication. If there was insufficient evidence.
That's correct. That's the implication there.
What was the error in Jones? Was it an instruction, jury instruction error?
Well, that's what they held, yes.
And in this case,
it said that regarding the jury instruction regarding ineffective consent raised the possibility the verdict was based on an alternative means that was that had not had sufficient evidence. So that was the case.
Well, the instructional error was a lack of unanimity instruction, right, for one. And then there was a lack of instruction as to the consent, ineffective consent, four That's ways to prove it. And there was no instruction as to that.
I believe that's the case.
But in this case, there is...
There was an RCO instruction as to the act.
Right. There was a unanimity instruction.
Yes.
And in this case, you have a situation where there was no instructional error. It's a sufficiency of evidence issue.
Well, apparently the ICA thought there was an instructional error. The ICA thought that
there may have done that, but in terms of, well, what was the instructional error?
The disorderly conduct was not defined according to the statute. That was what the ICA opined.
In this situation, is it the prosecution's position that the lost my train of thought here.
I've done that frequently, Your Honor.
If there is no instructional error in this case, and it's a sufficiency of evidence matter that we're dealing with here, and if there was no sufficient evidence in regards to one of the incidents, first floor or second floor, and you could not tell whether or not the jury was unanimous on one or the other, is there a double jeopardy issue that's raised here?
As to the means?
Yes.
If there was not a...
insufficient evidence on one alternative means?
According to Jones, if there was, if there's sufficient evidence on one of the alternatives, then the retrial is not barred.
Okay, again, I make a distinction between the trial error or...
the jury instruction? Right. I can't speculate on that, Your Honor. I can only deal with the facts that as presented, and I really couldn't speculate on that.
So is it, I think counsel for the petition indicated that he could not tell how the jury found on which alternative means by the general verdict that was issued.
That's correct.
Is that your position as well?
Well,
there's no way to tell which.
Given that there were two alternatives presented, the refusal to leave on the first floor and the refusal to leave on the second floor, I don't think it can be told, which one was presented.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Did these various and different officers, four of them attested to the evidence in the matter, and I think that even the testimony of Kainoa Jardine, defendant's friend, is that he heard the instructions and the police were down there. He even said that when he went downstairs following defendant, he observed fighting by the valet and parking. That's on page 158 of the same transcript. A lot of people getting arrested. That's what he observed when he came down, but the defendant didn't see that. But his friend did. Therefore, I believe that given the evidence as it is viewed in light for the state, in the sufficiency of the evidence viewed in the strongest light for the prosecution, I believe the state has given sufficient evidence on both that the defendant not only was involved in disorderly conduct, but he was also within the immediate vicinity of those that were fighting himself, that were also fighting. Lindstedt, case State versus Lindstedt, it was a real similar case where there was a similar type of drinking and music going on the beach, and defendant refused to leave. And everything was very similar. There was fights involved, and they held that the interest of the state is to allow law enforcement officers to stop disorderly conduct with its attendant harms to participants and bystanders, and that the request for movement is within the immediate vicinity of the disorderly conduct. Therefore, if they're saying he went from the first floor to the second floor, the state's response to that is he never left the disorderly conduct. The disorderly conduct continued. And that's where I'm not, no argument that it's a continuous course of action, because obviously the state stipulated there were two acts to prove up this conduct. But the conduct, the disorderly conduct, he never left the scene of the disorderly conduct because he carried the disorderly conduct with him. And that's the state's position, Your Honor. Honors. Also, State versus Gaylord says that mere difficulty in ascertaining the meaning of a statute or the fact that it is susceptible to interpretation will not render it nugatory. The jury could justifiably have drawn the conclusion from the evidence adduced that the defendant was not only one of the mob of disorderly actors who refused to disperse, but that he was within the immediate vicinity of other disorderly conduct on both floors. This court has repeatedly stated that the evidence adduced in trial court must be considered in the strongest light for the prosecution. When an appellate court passes on the legal sufficiency of such evidence to support a conviction, given the quantity of this evidence, Your Honors, supporting defendant's behavior, the state asks that this honorable court confirm the ICA's remand of the case for retrial.
Just briefly, and it took a little time for the light bulb to come on because it was not presented directly in our petition based on sufficiency. Perhaps, Mr. Chief Justice, there is a double jeopardy problem in this case. Given, and if you put together the questions from Justice Acoba, given that the Arceo instruction here was generic and did not address specifically whether it went to the different, what happened on the first floor or the second floor, as well as with regard to the alternative means. In fact, we could have the scenario potentially that the jury came back and convicted based on the scenario where there was insufficient evidence. And if that certainly is the case and the court finds that there is insufficient evidence with regard to one of the scenarios, then in fact we do have, as you suggested, potentially a double jeopardy problem in that the jury found there was insufficient evidence. The jury did not convict based on what the court will remand this case for. So for example, if the court finds that there was insufficient evidence for the first floor and remands the case for for what happened on the second floor, I see my time is up. May I finish my thought?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. And the court remands the case for what happened on the second floor. And even within the second floor, what with regard to the alternative means, perhaps the jury did not. Perhaps the jury did not convict on that. The jury convicted on what happened on the first floor. And in that case, I do agree it does, because the RCO instruction was generic, it does raise a double jeopardy problem. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. I take this matter under advisement.